Welcome to Phantom Astronaut. I'd like to thank all of the Phantom Astronaut patrons for supporting the show. If you enjoy the podcast and would like to support the show, visit phantomastronaut.com for all the different ways that you can help us continue to create. Today I'm speaking with hemophilia advocate and musician Max Feinstein. Hi, Max. Thanks for joining me.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having.
So where exactly are you right now? What part of the country?
So I'm in New Jersey, and more specifically, I'm sitting in my recording studio, Silver Horse Sound, in Union City, New Jersey.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I know Union City, Jersey City. I actually used to live in Hoboken for a little bit.
So. No way. I grew up in Hoboken.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I lived across from, funny enough, a restaurant venue called Maxwell's.
Kind of a namesake of mine. I grew up two blocks away.
Hey, rock and roll, dude. That's awesome. See, there's a lot of synergy there. So obviously,
when were you there? Like what period of time were you living there?
Oh, I want to say 2008, 2010, somewhere around there. Okay. So I was only there for a couple of years.
We might have crossed paths. There's so many people in Hoboken.
Yeah, my spouse actually had lived there longer. She went to Stevens Institute of Technology, right up in the on the river there. And really, really nice place, you know, interesting people. I guess the neighborhood at the time I was going through a little bit of it was sort of, I don't want to call it gentrifying because that has like a lot of loaded
don't
stuff.
Don't worry. Stuff. I will call it gentrifying. I will do that for you. There's a Fugazi song that I'm particularly fond of called Cash Out. Mm-hmm. And there's a line in it. Development wants, development gets. It's official. Development wants this neighborhood gone and the city just wants the same. The reason I'm in Union City is because for 9 years I had a studio in Hoboken, and unfortunately there was a fire that burned the building, and it was a situation in which everybody just kind of threw their hands up, and now it's about to become condos and a Whole Foods or something. So my romance for the city has faded, but for very specific people and very specific places. And I mourn because when I was a kid, when I was growing up in Hoboken, like 03, 04, I was like a 13-year-old. I used to roam the streets at night. I used to wait till my parents fell asleep. I used to sneak out and go to the Malibu Diner at 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. and get a cheeseburger and a cup of coffee. And I'd have, you know, my cargo pants and my giant Radio Shack headphones and my CD player and like a notebook or two. And I would just be, you know, this 14-year-old kid at 3 a.m. in a diner with a burger just hanging out. Writing, like, it was normal.
There's such a weird idiosyncratic thing about the Malibu Diner, and I know this is so off topic from the kinds of things that we wanted to talk about together today, but you just brought back like a core memory, like you unlocked something.
I love when that happens.
They used to make these like deep fried corn fritters.
Yes, they did.
And I don't know anywhere else that I've ever been that like actually makes and sells these things. It was like, because it was like whole kernels of corn, like not a hush puppy, not a like big doughy thing. It was just like these tiny little nuggets.
It was like a miniature hush puppy with corn kernels in it.
Yeah.
It was like you took hush puppy batter and stirred corn for like from a
it was definitely more corn than puppy, you know.
God, so unfortunately the Malibu is, there are no diners in Hoboken anymore at this moment. Spa and Malibu are both gone. However, it seems there is a plan to bring Malibu back again at the bottom of the high rise. But if it comes back, that's I only have so much room to be bitter about it. I spent so much time being bitter about it. I'm trying to move on. It was an important bitterness to have, and it was a very real reason to have it, which is, I think, both interesting. I think it's interesting because in a way that makes it worse, because you have the right to hold on to this. You have the right to feel this way, which in a lot of ways makes it difficult to know when it's appropriate to put it down because you've got vindication on your side, you know?
Yeah, no, I do know. Even during that period, it was a very, there were a lot of things kind of coming and going. It was a transitional time. And I mean, we didn't leave because of any pressures of the city itself, but there was also a little bit of like a cruelty to Hoboken. I remember there was one weird quirk about the handicap parking spaces. Do you know about this?
Yes, I do. Wait, what about the handicap parking spaces? Because we had one of those.
So like in normal, you know, life, you know, you can park in the handicap parking space and you need a state handicap sticker, right?
Yeah, the placard.
Yeah, the placard, the thing you hang up, whatever it is on the, you know, on your car. And in Hoboken, so what would happen is you would get all these people, because Hoboken is obviously a big hub. You've got the
are you talking about the residential handicap passes?
Yeah. So you would need to like have a Hoboken specific extra pass to use the handicap street parking. And I remember there was like somebody who had come in and they were handicapped and they parked in the handicap spot and they'd gone into a store. And when they were coming out, like this, it's this guy in a wheelchair, you know, and he's like coming out of this store and he's getting like a $250 ticket for parking in the handicap spot. And the cops just did not care.
Well, it's a little more specific than just residential. It's specific to a person specifically, like a single person gets that spot. A resident of Hoboken, I don't know if they have to be an owner or just a resident with enough going for them. And my mother had one of those at the end of her life. We had a handicapped spot and we used to do exactly that because on those signs, you would find a specific code that would correspond to the sticker on the vehicle. And if it wasn't yours, you know, like we see, the law doesn't care how handicapped you are a lot of the time. And this happens to be one of those situations where it's super easy to misinterpret because I've been, you know, as a hemophiliac, I hang out with other hemophiliacs sometimes and we have those disability placards. And I had to warn a buddy of mine. I'm like, you can't park here. He's like, yeah, I can. I'm like, no, you can't. He's like, why? And I'm like, you see that number there is for a specific car and you're going to get that fine. And they love giving them out, you know? But also, what do you do in a city? Like, how do you, it's a thing, you know?
Oh no, it's definitely a thing. I mean, like the thing about Hoboken is that they will always find interesting ways to give you a ticket. It was probably one of the most heavily ticketed places I've ever lived. But you bring up something interesting, which is the core of what we wanted to talk about today. You are a hemophilia advocate. And, you know, I'm curious about, you know, what that, I know broadly what hemophilia is, but why don't you tell the audience exactly what it is and what an advocate does to educate the public about it?
Well, it's exactly this, and this is my personal forte, you know, as a musician and as an artist interfacing outward and having these things begs a lot of questions, and I've gotten pretty good at finding colorful and somewhat not scientific methods of describing it that people can internalize. So I'm going to dispel immediately what hemophilia isn't. Hemophilia is a bleeding disorder, but what people abstractly take that to mean is any bleeding is bad. That if you cut yourself, you know, the big one that I grew up with, that everybody grew up with, is a paper cut would kill me. And it's like, if you know anything about how the heart works, unless you really hurt yourself, you're not going to bleed out. You're making blood faster than you're bleeding it. Like, that's not, even if you never stop bleeding from a paper cut, it's not like a fountain of blood or anything. What it is, and this is a little lesson on the human circulatory system. This is how everybody works. The human body is a magnificent machine with a lot of things going on that, of course, we feel. But then there's all this stuff that we don't know about, all these automated subroutines that the machine that is our body goes through. And one of that is blood circulation. And you've got your blood bumping around through your system, going through parts of your body, going through your heart, just going through. And part of that process is what's called microscopic bleeding. And you are doing it right now. And anybody listening to this is doing it right now. But you're also clotting on a microscopic level. It's basically kind of a course correction. And the human body has a perfectly balanced scale of proteins on one side for clotting and on another side for anti-clotting. That is to say, a microscopic bleed happens, which is by nature how it happens, bumping around the bloodstream, and that protein sequence engages and stops the bleeding. And when it has stopped the bleeding, the other protein sequence engages so that you don't end up with a clot somewhere like your brain or in your lung or wherever it so happens. So you've got these two processes in place to keep the body in balance. And hemophilia is lacking a certain amount of one of those proteins because they kick off in a sequence. So it's, if you imagine a row of dominoes with one domino a little too short to knock the next one over, that's kind of what you get. And when you take this concept of microscopic bleeding and leave it unchecked, you end up effectively with a hemophilic episode. It's most bleeding for hemophiliacs is internal by that design. And what it really looks like is bleeding into joints, because by this logic, walking is a form of trauma, you know? Clapping is a form of trauma. Like, my big story is I saw one of my favorite bands when I was 17, Porcupine Tree, and I saw them at Town Hall, and it was an amazing show, and they played my favorite song, and I clapped, because that's what you do. You know, music for clapping, and the nature of clapping my hands together because I liked a song was enough to cause me to bleed into my elbow. Like, and what that looks like and feels like is, imagine not being able to extend your elbow, just like that it's affixed at less than a straight 180 degree angle. And then there's a lot of pain in there as a result. It's painful. It's debilitating. And if these episodes happen too much, they obliterate the cartilage in your joints. So there's a lot of that. That's the long form of hemophilia and the more specific repercussions, because the short of it is, if bleeding is bad for you, it's way bad for me, but most of the other stuff is managed. It's a managed condition, kind of like the way diabetes is managed, not one-to-one methodology, but like we treat at home by and large. But back in the day when I was growing up, every time this was a problem, it was a literal medical emergency. We'd have to go to a hospital and do that sort of thing. And hemophilia itself has a great heritage in America and globally through the AIDS epidemic as well. We were sort of on the front lines of that in terms of, well, we were not ground zero, but we were a group of people who were getting infected with HIV because our medicine was blood-based. Was based off of plasma and such. And there was a period of time in which the blood supply was contaminated and a period of time in which people were not necessarily heat treating the medicine to make it guaranteed safe. And a very, very difficult decision that many people don't agree with, and I won't opine on it myself, was made to keep medicine circulating in the community that might get them sick, because it was better to run that risk than to go unmedicated. And there was a young man named Ryan White who became the poster boy for AIDS, who was a hemophiliac. And so you had this community of people who, you know, their lives literally were depending on this, and they were working with Dr. Fauci at the time on this stuff. And basically hemophilia across the globe sort of spearheaded the processes and the research that got us to where we ultimately ended up going with it, HIV and treatments and such. So we've been there for a while doing this stuff. We've been advocating for a while, and it's made in America for some very potent advocacy. We legislate, you know, we lobby. We go down to Capitol Hill every March to talk about matters of healthcare reform. And that's the sort of thing that, yes, we're a special interest group, but what this really is if you think about it in a way, we are like that little krill or plankton, that thing in the ecosystem that the humans don't know about. But if something's wonky about that, everything else in the ecosystem is going to be wonky. And that's how you can consider, you know, the well-being of a society, that the health of society can be considered as to how it takes care of its most unwell people. And when you have chronically ill people with painfully expensive medicine that can't get access to the care they need, it stands to reason more simple things are going to start looking bad as well. Or people with other conditions that don't have that kind of advocacy potential behind them are going to be failed. So, you know, and again, I'm not opining in any direction on, I don't have the answers to what healthcare reform in America looks like, but I do know that it, you know, this is a conversation that need be had, that we are better off than we were in the 90s when people with pre-existing conditions were discriminated against for being unwell by health insurance. That is now something that you can't do, but we always have room to improve. So that is sort of what advocacy is. Advocacy in this way is me talking a little bit, educating about the disorder, how it plays a role in my everyday life, talking about things like the requirements to sustain a life with this disorder and how it impacts beyond our community and speaks to the, you know, again, the greater health of the American society.
I mean, that was always one of the absolute best things about the Affordable Care Act was the removal of pre-existing conditions. And, you know, I think all that stuff that happened around the time that it was being passed was so frustrating to me, you know, hearing, I mean, look, you know, there are some other issues that are along with it, but there was also a lot of good. And I think this was probably the most good. To share a slightly unrelated personal story, my wife's mother passed away from cancer many years ago, and she was born in Japan. She married an American citizen, and she never, I don't think that she ever actually became a citizen. She just kind of assumed that you get married and you become a citizen. I don't think she filed her paperwork. So what ended up happening was when she was diagnosed with cancer, this insurance that she'd been paying into for, you know, all of her life, or her husband had been paying into, just flat out said, well, you're not an American citizen, so we're kicking you off of this plan. So then, you know, she went to get a, you know, she corrected all that. She went to go get another plan, and they denied her because they said that the cancer is a pre-existing condition because she had the cancer when she was trying to sign up for this new plan after the other one had canceled her. And, you know, it was great expense. It was horrible. And I can only imagine, you know, when you have, you mentioned Ryan White, one thing to remember about Ryan White and why he was so poignant was that he was, you know, a young kid, right?
So yeah, it was like, he was very young.
Yeah. And you look at that and you go, well, what's a kid with a pre-existing condition supposed to do in a system like that? And I think that's one of the things that makes it so powerful. And what happens, you know, on a regular basis, maintenance wise, for hemophiliacs? Because there's a couple of things that you touched on that I think I'd love to revisit. One is that you talked about how there's a lot of internal bleeding issues that lead to, you know, an increased or unsustainable amount of blood in things like the joints. Now, when we think of things like hemophiliacs needing blood transfusions, I think the popular consciousness is that they need it because they lose so much blood. And you're saying that that's not necessarily true. So why don't you walk me through like what the actual maintenance and treatments for hemophiliacs look like?
So it used to be that transfusions were how this worked. And it was because of the plasma. There were, and that's eventually where we ended up with, was essentially fresh frozen plasma transfusions, because it's not the blood itself that's required in most cases. It is the augmentation of a protein deficiency that we have. These proteins are called clotting factors, and hemophilia is a broader family of clotting factor deficiencies that can refer to a handful of different ones that perform differently in the chain of proteins than each other. I am hemophilia type A, which is a deficiency of the protein factor 8, and that's the more common type of hemophilia. And so essentially what I'm trying to do when I manage this condition is put myself in a place where I am raising the percentage of that factor level in my body to a place in which it will maintain where I'm at, like if I'm doing this microscopic bleeding or if I have trauma within reason, let's say, you know, like a car crash is going to be a problem for anyone. But like, you know, if I fall down a flight of stairs, like just my ass scooting down a flight of stairs, something like that, I don't know, maybe even that's unreasonable, but I think you get the point. The idea from there became, from transfusions became infusions of non-human based products that were designed to behave the way that factor proteins in humans do, but to have no connection to human plasma so as to be guaranteed safe from that kind of contamination at the time. That was one of the pivots that our community made, was into a recombinated factor product that was derived from Chinese hamster ovaries, of all things. And so the maintenance at this point in life looks like periodic self-infusions of that medicine. So when you start to become responsible for your own treatment, you learn how to infuse yourself. You learn how to do, you know, you learn how to stick a needle in your veins. You learn how to properly do that. And that's exactly the same mechanism by way that a nurse takes your blood. You're accessing a vein. So instead of getting a blood draw, I'm just sending medicine into my body that way. And you're doing this on a maintenance level because the medicine has a half-life and it will diminish. You get yourself up to a certain percentage. Like, let's say my percentage of factor VIII is 1%. I have 1/100th what a normal human is born with. And you would be taking enough of the medicine to get you up to a certain percentage. And then after so many hours, that percentage is halved. It has a half-life. So by the time you are hitting the trough, the low point of that half-life, you're re-bolstering that percentage. You're doing another infusion. It's called prophylaxis. So let's say, you know, in my case, I'm infusing 3 times a week. You know, that's the kind of thing. And if you have problems like breaking through that treatment regimen, you treat on demand. That's effectively the most basic common school of thought on hemophilia treatment is the prophylactic regimen, because what you want to do is stop the bleeding from happening in the first place. Because a lot of times if you're treating on demand, it's literally when you're in a triage situation and you've got that blood where blood isn't supposed to be. Now, what's happening there is the blood is getting reabsorbed into the system. Now that it can start to clot, you can start to deal with that. And that's, you know, it takes time. And after too many of those, and in some cases once is too many, the joint starts to deform because it has all of this pressure and all of this excess fluid going where it's not supposed to go. Eventually, that's going to start causing wear and tear. So in my case, between the ages of 17 and 21, I bled into the aforementioned elbow so prolifically that by the time I was 21, I didn't really have any cartilage left. And now at 35, I've worn a hole through my elbow. And that is both really cool and really horrifying. I have to think about it as cool, because if I don't, then what do I have? I'm naturally inclined, perhaps because I grew up with a disorder that is, you know, let's be real here. This is literal horror. We're talking about literal gore in a way. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not objectively horrifying. So to talk about it like this and to find humor and fascination and unorthodox ways of thinking about it has become my coping mechanism to say, oh yeah, I'm a lifelong science experiment, you know? Like, my blood is on file with the CDC or something. Or as my friends say, I'm such a dick, not even my blood wants to work with me. You know, there's all these ways to try and make light of it, because otherwise, what do you have? You have constant pain and this sort of knowledge that you don't really get to get better. You know, that was the thing I heard as a 21-year-old. Like, oh, you should stop playing guitar. And I asked, will that help? Will it make it better? And effectively, the doctor let me know we were well past better being an opportunity. So I decided if I was going to be bleeding anyway and in pain anyway, to ultimately choose what gave me that pain or what I was going to do well in pain, because otherwise, what was I, you know, what do you do? What do you do in those cases? And I'm naturally iconoclastic to begin with, but at that point, it's like you give up the things that make you happy. And I'm lucky because the science has gotten to where it is now that by the time I was 21, it was messed up. By the time some people of older generations were that age, they might have been getting ready for a second set of knees. You know, or they might have been in wheelchairs or walking with canes. You know, it speaks to not only the way that science does move forward, but also the things that science can't do. Case in point, we are also the pioneers of gene therapy. Hemophiliacs, there it was, the approval of a CRISPR gene therapy called Hemgenics. That was a big news thing about a year ago. It is the most expensive treatment in the world, but it is effectively a gene therapy for hemophilia, and that sets the state standard for other disease states to take what may have worked for us and apply it to their needs. But that said, I could be cured tomorrow, literally. Literally by magic or whatever, I could be instantaneously not a hemophiliac any longer, and I would still be living with all of the damage that I have. You know, that's a reality of it, is I could stop bleeding into my joints altogether right now and forevermore, and I would still be living with 1 3/4 of an elbow. There's something magnificent about science, but also it's very, very real, the places in which science is impotent.
It's interesting to me because obviously, you know, you've articulated that hemophiliacs sort of have a sense of community, and you organize and you know, do advocacy, and you go to Washington, D.C. and all this stuff. And there have been some great advancements that have taken place because of, you know, that sense of community. But I also draw a parallel. I have some friends that are deaf, and they have a very strong community as well. And there's a controversy that's happening in their universe right now where parents are able to sort of opt to have children fitted with things like cochlear implants and things that will give them, you know, a relatively normalized sense of hearing if they're, you know, found to be, you know, deaf or very close to deaf when they're just infants still. And that controversy is that, you know, a lot of people who are deaf say, well, that's going to destroy this community that we've built. People shouldn't be doing that. We want, you know, deaf people to exist in this world because we have such a strong sense of identity around who we are. I'm not here to litigate that or pass judgment on either side of that conversation. But I am curious, when you say that there are these gene therapies, and realistically, if they become affordable enough within the next 20 to 30 years, this is the kind of thing that, if applied to people early, could essentially remove hemophilia from something that people have to live with. It could be stricken from our society. Theoretically, what do you personally feel, and what do you feel is the temperature of the community? Is that something that the community embraces, or is that something that is controversial?
I'm really glad you asked that, because it is absolutely a community concern. The, let's call it, the stability, integrity of a community like that. I had trouble in the sense of, you know, thinking about that. I'm also familiar with the controversy around cochlear implants, and it's hard for me to say, because in my mind, I think about, and like reflexively, I thought about it, and I'm like, everybody should have a shot at working the way a human being is designed to work. You know, everybody should have a shot at that. In my opinion, I can't make that decision for anybody else. I would personally, just having known disability throughout my life, if I could have a cochlear implant, you bet I would want one, because that would be enabling. Like, and that's not just, maybe it's because I'm a musician and sound is such an important part of my life that I feel this way. But moreover, I'd like to, before I get into my answer here, just for one thing, say that the gene therapy isn't a cure. The gene therapy is at this stage designed to boost the resting natural factor percentage of a hemophiliac into a range that is far less likely to make it a everyday concern, that would put them perhaps into the on-demand status that we talked about before, because there are graduations of severity of hemophilia, and when you're a mild hemophiliac, it stands to reason that you will have fewer spontaneous bleeding episodes and therefore not need as much medicine. And that being said, we are already seeing this in our community, in part because of the protections that we fought for. That's the double-edged sword of it, is that we were fighting for protections, we were fighting for help, we were fighting against discrimination, and we are perhaps the best taken care of disease state, because there's, if I'm being generous, maybe 2,500 hemophiliacs in America that are diagnosed, and that's kind of the whole family of bleeding disorders. Let's say we're like white tigers or something in that, like we're pretty well taken care of. We have good protections. We have nonprofits in more territories than states. So like over 50 national, like nonprofits across the country that care for their constituents in a way that, you know, helps them get in touch with the resources they need, the treatment centers, and fosters community through events and programming and such. So community is a very big deal, not just for the feels of it, but also for the integrity of the stability of whatever protections are afforded. Because I can't tell you how easy it would be to walk any of that back, but it terrifies me to think that it may. The reality herein, though, is the science is improving, and not just the gene therapy. I will strike that from the shelf after saying right now the best way I can imagine gene therapy working is you give it to a child young, because the thing I didn't mention is that boost in levels is not a permanent thing. It's supposed to taper and fall off after about 5 years or so. So the best time to get that to somebody, in my opinion, and this has been a conversation as well, where it's kind of like we've done the thing, we've made a massive breakthrough in science, and all we got was this t-shirt. Like, you know, it might mean something a lot more for somebody else, and I would love that. But to me, administering that to a young individual, like you said, is the move, but so that they can properly condition their body to be more resilient against harm. That's been one of the best things I could do for myself, is to be very active, even with my damage. I'm still keeping moving. I'm still, you know, doing things that strengthen me. And as a result, I bleed less. And so to give somebody a fair shot at going hard at their vessel to prevent this stuff down the line is about the most logical place my patient brain can take it. But the more real danger and the more real situation, because I am an example of this, is what happens in the community is when you're born with hemophilia, your parents turn to the aforementioned nonprofits and they get involved. They're scared. They don't know anything about this. And the nonprofits help out and they feel like people understand them, and they find other people that are also fighting tooth and nail for their kids or their spouse or whoever. They start volunteering, you know, the community, you know, it becomes more family-based. But as children grow older, they fall off because they feel the need to make their own way in the world. You know, that was part of it for me. I used to go to these events a lot, but I also, in a way, because of my own mental bend, resented going there because it felt like nobody was meeting me where I needed to be met. It felt like, you know, at the time, as a cynical 7-year-old because you're learning med school jargon at the exact same time as you're learning what words are, so that you can tell people when something's wrong with you, because you're a child. Everybody but you is responsible for you, so you have to be responsible for yourself by telling people that something is wrong, because they don't have hemophilia. They don't understand. They can't see anything on the inside of you. So after a long time of doing that and feeling super cynical about big pharma, you know, you divorce yourself from the community. You may not do it in a deliberate screw this, I'm out of here way, but my personal story in this is that I felt like too much of my life revolved around it, and that it wasn't, you know, I wasn't well enough for it to feel like that. And cynical brain is going to interpret that sort of community solidarity as almost cartoonish, like, all right, everybody, who's stoked to have blood that doesn't work? Like, it just felt like this very absurdist, give me an H kind of like pep rally feel. But at the same time, of course it is. You need to be like a generator of energy in order to get any level of activism legwork to go anywhere. You need to be a goddamn dynamo. And all these dynamos are women. You know, it's a very overwhelmingly female-led thing. But yeah, to back to the thing, yeah, kids fall off because their treatment now is getting to the point where the protections for most people are well enough, you know, they work well enough that they don't need to be as involved. They can do more. They can go off into the world and make their way and nobody has to know. Which I get and I respect, and I respect that people become jaded with the community, because in our case, Big Pharma is hand in hand with us. They are the collaborators with the nonprofits, are the manufacturers. And I'm talking like Pfizer. I'm talking, one of the big ones is called Octapharma, but there's, you know, brands, you know, the Pfizer and Bayer, you know, the brands that make products that are commonly used by other people as well, you know, are, but you don't have to deal with those people in real life. Here, this becomes a quandary because Big Pharma has faces now, because they're members of the community too. Even if they don't have the disorder, they play an administrative role and a liaison's role between the pharma and the community, and they help people get what they need. So these people have faces, and we are directly. It's a weird and nebulous place to be able to say that I literally rely on Big Pharma to be alive. Literally. I am one of those people who, you know, my medicine is literally life-saving. And I don't really have a choice about that. I don't get to choose my principles on that matter as much. And It's a different perspective, in the same way that I am a white man, but I am also a form of a minority in being disabled, in having this rare disorder. It's not nearly on par with racial inequity, or, I mean, I'm queer and I identify more into the a they place, but, you know, I would say that by and large, I haven't had any sort of discriminative aspects for that as much as the hemophilia, where you're far more of a minority at that point. Like I'm 1 in 2,500 or something in America. So to have that perspective while also coming from a handful of places of privilege is very interesting to me. And like, I have a friend named Sam, and Sam has lupus. And because of what I've done here, you know, what I've learned in this community about advocating, I was looking to see what resources could be afforded for her. And the Lupus Foundation of New Jersey is literally just one guy, like, who is in over his head. And I think that he may have even started the nonprofit himself with his wife, who has or passed away from lupus. So and lupus is a far more prevalent disorder. So you have all of these interesting interplays of the politics of disability, the politics of pharma. Like, it's a lot. It really is. You do have to have an appetite for it. And if you're still trying to get a wrangle on a disorder, you don't have the bandwidth for it. I don't think I didn't have the bandwidth for it.
You know, this kind of reminds me a little bit of a frustration point during the COVID-19 pandemic for me, where, you know, it ripped apart the fabric of society, or at least exposed, you know, rifts that may have been festering in a way that we hadn't seen before. And a lot of that is, you know, distrust of people, like you mentioned Fauci earlier, and, you know, Big Pharma, and all this confluence of capitalism and politics and personal autonomy and healthcare. And it all just kind of imploded into this sort of massive thing that we were experiencing. And one thing that I heard pretty frequently was, well, they don't know what they're talking about. They were telling us to not wear masks. Now they're telling us to wear masks, and now they want us to get a vaccine. But I know a friend who had a vaccine and he still got COVID. So the vaccine doesn't work. It's a lie. And underpinning all of these public health messages and things that we were experiencing during that time was one thing that was very clear to me. And I tried to explain this to other people. I go, all of these measures that we're taking during the pandemic aren't necessarily to create an ironclad, bulletproof way for us not to get sick. They're to stagger the amount of people that are sick at any moment in time, because we don't have the healthcare infrastructure to support this influx of patients, and also support people who need regular ongoing health care. And I can imagine that may have been a bit frustrating for you too. I don't know if you had a similar experience to that.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought this up, because, and I'll get to something. I know we're both staying essentially like drawing lines. We're not hinging ourselves to any side of an argument or taking sides in any way. This isn't a color war. This is an issues-based discussion. And I would agree with that. A lot of the cool thing about the hemophilia community is that it is an absolute microcosm of society, because it is national. Therefore, you have worldviews and circumstances of life that are very, very disparate, and a fairly interesting replica of the melting pot that is America. One of my favorite people in the bleeding disorders community is an absolute QAnoner, which is not something that I line up with. However, it's not what we talk about. Like, it's not something that they're being active or kind of belligerent about. They just, you know, I don't know how or what their conspiracy theories mean to them in certain ways. I'm not here to get into Andochrone or any of that, but it doesn't matter. We love the Mars Volta. We love smoking pot and listening to the Mars Volta and going to a Chinese buffet and going to the museum. Like, we do other things, because when you think about it, and this is something, I have a lot of incredibly principled friends. My wife is one of the most principled and incredibly just, she's, if I could be half the person my wife is, I'd still be a scumbag. Like, the problem, unfortunately, with having such broad / high ideals is that it does leave less room for the complexity and ambiguity that is the human animal. We are complicated people, and I would like to think by and large that if we took a look at the people with opposing views to us, maybe, you know, I don't know, I'm not going to put a statistic on it, but it would be very interesting to see who might not, let's take a controversial topic. Let's take gay politics. Let's take the rainbow flag. You may never see one of these people raising up the rainbow flag in solidarity, but they're the kind of people that probably wouldn't stand for the discrimination against homosexuals if it was happening in front of them. They're the kind of people who might not really agree with the lifestyle, but they also don't agree with treating a human being worse, or they don't believe that the reasoning behind their disagreement with it puts them above other people. In fact, I had a situation that was very interesting to me within the community where it opened my eyes, where I had a conversation with somebody who, you know, grew up rurally, and their background reflected that Southern rural upbringing. A lovely person, lovely family. Their beliefs are quite linear, that man is man, woman is woman. There is no shifting what you are, and like shall not mate with like. And that is their biblical view on the matter. And that's fine. I don't want to take it away from them. My own upbringing in a coastal city reflects my own perspective on things. And all I said in this way is, I'm like, you know, we live in America. One of the inalienable rights that we have is the pursuit to happiness and the liberty to pursue it. And so long as nobody is impeding the civil liberties of other people, disagree all you want. You can not like it, but you got to understand that it has as much right to be around us as anything. And what this individual said to me about it was, yeah, essentially that, yes, homosexuality to them was a sin, but that it was no greater a sin than any other original sin. And that within the Christian worldview is basically the moment you're born, you're on parole. We are all born with original sin. So in that respect, nobody is better than anybody. Everybody is a sinner. It's a take that we can say hate the sin, not the sinner, but it's a take that almost makes the sin less significant if we're looking at a religious individual who isn't actively impeding civil liberties. You know, for some people, unfortunately, what they would call pejoratively the snowflake status is real, and that knows no political affiliation, but there are people who absolutely can't stand to know that somebody disagrees with this stuff. And it's a hard pill to swallow because, you know, sexuality is a non-negotiable, or gender dysphoria is very real, or any of those things that can't be helped. There's discrimination against the disabled because of things out of their control. It's not like I did anything to get hemophilia. It's not like Ryan White was using heroin and having sex to get AIDS. You know, that was actually a problem back then, was like when it was that Ryan was diagnosed with HIV, people thought he was gay. You know, the politics of the time were to make the jokes about it. And I go back.
Oh, no, very, very much so. And, you know, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I did want to make this point, too, that when Ryan White was happening, I mean, I was a kid. I was probably about the same age as Ryan White. And, you know, you'd watch this unfold, and what I would see happening in the time right after Ryan White, because there was a, for people who weren't around at that time, it was really, really all encompassing. I mean, you had Ryan White at the White House. There was a big thing, you know, Ron and Nancy Reagan would, you know, kind of bring Ryan White around and walk him around. Now, the thing about that is that, you know, Ronald Reagan, not exactly the coolest guy to queer people. You know what I mean? Nope. So what you ended up seeing in the aftermath of this was it didn't just go from, oh, this is something, HIV and AIDS doesn't just affect gay people. I mean, that's luckily been the long-term takeaway, but the immediate takeaway was, see, now something that gay people are doing is also hurting these innocent children. And it led to, if you can believe it, an even more increased and entrenched kind of homophobia that sort of walked hand in hand with hemophilia advocacy. And I'm not saying that it was the advocates themselves who were putting this forward, but it was a lot of people who are bigoted were using that as an excuse to be bigoted, whether they cared about hemophiliacs or not.
Finish your thought.
Oh, no, please. You go on ahead.
So a lot, that is the truth. In fact, it would be the kind of thing where people might not even read the article. They just might see Ryan White and think that he was, you know, promiscuous, or that he did something to deserve this. They don't know what hemophilia is. It's a lot. Again, all of this is very abstract, and I do believe it, because at the time, this was not the same kind of discussion that was having. You know, my mother, we were still in a time where bearding was a thing. When my mother was growing up in the 60s in Lodi, New Jersey, she at one point was a beard for another man. And those who don't know what a beard is, it is when you pretend to be in a heterosexual relationship with a homosexual individual to throw off suspicion of their sexuality from discriminating parties. And I'm Italian American, and Lodi is an Italian American town. And the views of Italian Americans on homosexuality at that point were very, very well illustrated in The Sopranos. So, you know, a lot of that was, you know, I do believe that. And the reason I go back to Ryan White in connection with what you said about COVID is the one thing I am qualified to say. What I could not stand for during this lockdown were individuals who attempted to curry favor with Donald Trump, the expense of Fauci's reputation. And you can have your opinions about Fauci and how things went and how things went with COVID as well as AIDS. But what you can't do, and what was happening, was say that Fauci spread a false narrative that HIV leads to AIDS. That is called AIDS denialism. That was something that became mildly trendy in the 90s and is a very, very dangerous, to say nothing of how incorrect and bafflingly stupid to me, as a hemophiliac who comes from that culture of HIV, we know it leads to AIDS. Trust us. We did the research. We have the receipts. We lost so many people. HIV leads to AIDS. I'm not going to sit here and tell people how to live their lives. I'm not here to tell you that Fauci is a saint. I'm not here to cover for anybody's reputation, but you have individuals like Judy Mikovits, who I will name specifically, but you had because her research was on this and she falsified it. And then she comes back to try and get this relevance with that Plandemic documentary, and whatever point might have been had is squandered by what seems to be an attempt to either galvanize already fringe disenfranchised individuals with shit they want to hear, or curry favor with the powers that be like Donald Trump, who might be able to absolve them of disgrace or put them into places of prominence. And what you'd hear, especially from others, Mikovits is the one who may have had the sturdiest leg to stand on, if that, but you'd hear it from people who were throwing their hats into the political ring. You just hear them say, oh yeah, not only did this, but Fauci also started a narrative that falsely says HIV leads to AIDS, and they would never elaborate on it. They would never elaborate on it, the same way that Donald Trump with repeal and replace would never elaborate on it. There was no, it was a thing that you said. It was a slogan, or it was another thing that you could say to try and make people who were already iffy about this guy, and maybe for valid reasons, like him even less. And in some cases, that just goes in one ear out the other, whatever. But there is, to me, or was to me at that point, because that was all happening somewhere around the summer or spring of 2020, when these people were popping their stupid heads up and trying to make points to a broader audience about this. I was legitimately scared that we were going to start seeing a resurgence of this school of thought in an actual way that we would have to care about, that we would actually have to deal with the way that we did in the 90s. You know, it's that that is the one thing I am allowed to say with certainty, because of the heritage of my community and because my community was literally the underbelly of this thing. This was, we were literally inextricable. We were the cutting edge of this research because we had to be. So don't tell me you know better unless you are literally a doctor. And I was going to say another thing, unless you were literally a doctor or HIV positive yourself, then you can have that discussion with me. And then, and now I'm off of my pulpit. That's the one thing. I don't claim to be an authority on anything, and I'm barely an authority on this, but I've got the receipts.
So one thing that I've learned from the two Fauci medical crises that we've gone through in my life, you know, the first, of course, being the AIDS epidemic, you know, all the research that you just talked about, and then of course Fauci carrying over to COVID. These are kind of like the two big social spikes that involve Fauci specifically and him and his reputation. What I've learned from that has nothing to do with Fauci. It has to do with the inability to have medical decisions, public health decisions, never be able to like make everybody happy, right? So, you know, whatever precautions you have to take, you know, because they are medically logical and whatever else for public health and awareness and safety, you know, you're always going to have a contingent of people that are going to be upset by them. Those two particular like social spikes that I talked about, politically speaking, the people that were, you know, angry about certain decisions are on the other side of the aisle. You know, one being you alluded to earlier about how gay people are not allowed to give blood transfusions and, you know, give, you know, things like that. That's still on the books. You know, that's debatable, you know, whether restricting it just because of sexuality is the proper way to do it. You know, I'm not here to have that discussion. But then the other thing, when we talk about COVID, it seems like it's much more conservatives about currying power with, you know, people like Trump and things like that. So regardless of which side of the political spectrum you're on, no one is ever going to be satisfied with public health decisions. No.
And it's not even that. This is so when Trump was elected, there was a lot of that Godwin's law being thrown around. There's a lot of, you know, there's always a lot of people saying that somebody is the next Hitler. That's one thing. And the other thing that people like to talk about is the decline of Western civilization, saying that we backslide. And so when Trump was elected, I heard a lot of that and I didn't know what to expect. So I went out and I got two books. I got a book on the life and times of Adolf Hitler, and I got a book on the history of our nation from its foundation into basically the Industrial Revolution. So I needed to know kind of where we started, and I needed to know how the other thing got to where it was. And what I found in this, you know, it's easy to almost compare certain things to the Civil War, because what you had there was people saying, you're going to destroy our way of life, you're going to destroy our industry, and other people saying, bro, you are literally holding other human beings in captivity. You are literally taking humanity away from these people. They are property to you. They are like cattle. You're dehumanizing people, and that shouldn't be a thing. You shouldn't be able to like make money off of that. And one particular senator, Charles Sumner, was making this point, and another one, Preston Brooks, decided he disagreed with it. So what did he do? He beat the crap out of him on the Senate floor with a heavy gentleman's walking stick. So, you know, the classic gentleman's walking stick is probably some kind of oak stick with a heavy brass or gold ball that you palm as you walk like a gentleman. So we're talking about something that was probably a cudgel, a very, very severe utilizing impact instrument here, to the point where this man was hospitalized for a while I don't know what it would have looked like with modern medicine, but there was absolutely cranial drainage that needed to happen. And I say this to say that we're not going backwards. We literally have been beating the shit out of each other over disagreements of perspective as long as human beings have been alive. And we're not going backwards in this, because what happened next is my favorite part. After Brooks did this, and he did this to such a ridiculous level that he absolutely destroyed the walking stick that he was using, he got fan mail, effectively. People sent him letters of support, and in one case, a brand new walking stick, either inscribed with or including a note that said something to the effect of, go at him again and kill him next time. Now, that sounds like a Facebook comment thread to me, if I've ever seen one. So, you know, in a way, I found that comforting to know that we have always been basically ridiculous with brief, unhinged periods of prosperity in between ridiculousness. So I try, you know, we try to take it in stride over that sort of thing to the best of my ability. And when people are saying we're going backwards, I'm like, what are you talking about? It used to be that we literally shot at each other over misunderstandings. So, like, it's all very interesting to me. And what's unfortunate is, like, you have a lot of these people who have a right to be upset as well, that there are lots of people for whom COVID effectively ruined their lives. The lockdowns ruined their livelihood. I was a person working in entertainment and events who, you know, we were the first thing to shut down and the last things to come back. So a lot of people did lose their jobs and suffered serious consequences for them, and were every right to be disgruntled and disenfranchised. And I'm not saying they were upset at the wrong people. That's not my call. That's above my pay grade. But that's how you can sneak these little nuggets of bullshit in. And everybody does it. That's just politics, is like sneaking in other things within broader agreeable points. And everybody does that. Everything is like that. And part of what made the Affordable Care Act something people like to complain about now is likely the amount of compromise that was required to get the other sides to agree to it, so that it was not quite the beacon of versatility that it was originally intended to be. And so through this compromise, or through just this broad stuff, you know, people are going to fall into whatever they're going to fall into.
Yeah, agreed. There's a couple of things that I wanted to go over with you before we run out of time. First, for people that are listening, you obviously can't see Max, but Max has a ton of tattoos. Yes, and they're
almost
cool.
30.
30, wow. And almost. That immediately goes back to the beginning of our conversation about risk, reward, myths about hemophilia. Earlier in the conversation, you said that, you know, when you were a kid, you used to kind of go out and sneak out on your own, walk the streets of Hoboken. Obviously, you have a very adventurous mentality. Now, what is the risk reward on some of these activities, like playing guitar for you, getting tattoos for you? And, you know, how do you make that judgment for yourself?
So at this point, I would say, do I want to do it? It's almost that simple, because I'm unfortunately an iconoclast at times, or as somebody said the other day in a room full of people, I know, I get it. We're all terminally unique. And it is to say that if I get my mind made up on something, I'm going to find a way to do it. And that's who I am across the board as a writer. I can call myself an inventor without hyperbole because I have a patent. That's another thing entirely. But let's be realistic here for a second. With tattoos, given that hemophilia is a managed condition, the risks at this point are non-existent, especially given how clean tattoo parlors have to be. at this point, because at one point, one of the big ones for hemophiliacs was hepatitis.
Yep.
That was a worry, and it used to be that there was a higher risk of getting hepatitis, and that was something I grew up thinking. And the more, you know, when I decided that I wanted to play rock, I was like, tattoos are the suit and tie of rock and roll, aren't they? That all these cool looking guys with all this, and girls with all this interesting body art and things that made them look counterculture and cool and expressive. And a lot of people didn't really see eye to eye with that in my life. Like my parents were decidedly anti-tattoos, and society reflected that to the point where my dad once said he would never let a man with a hand tattoo operate on him. However, you know, now I know doctors with hand tattoos. I know doctors, you know, like it's all stripes. And so for me, a tattoo, I came up with some kind of, I don't want to say a code, but like I made decisions for myself early on about body art and what I wanted on my body, more out of aesthetic, but also with a hint of practicality to it. So all of my tattoos are line work. They're all black. They're all black ink because I didn't want to fill things in with color. That would have been more time on the bench. That would have been more time being uncomfortable, because I do have a thick boy here that is, gave me an example of what it's like to have somebody basically sharpie you in with the equivalent of a sewing machine running across your arm. That's sort of what it feels like. I don't like getting them. I don't like the feeling. My wife likes the feeling of getting tattooed, but I like having them, so I get them. And to me, they mean something beyond, first, they do mean sort of I'm taking my body back for myself. You know I shouldn't have them because of hemophilia, but shouldn't is a really relative word here, because why the hell shouldn't I? It just because something makes you bleed, by that logic, I shouldn't get blood taken. You know, by that logic, that logic is so baseless when you think about the risks. At this point, the only risk is it going to be uncomfortable? And that's the kind of thing that stopped me from getting the palms of my hands tattooed, because I was speaking with somebody who had them done recently. They're like, yeah, this was literally the worst pain I've ever felt. I'm a pragmatist at heart in those ways. With guitar, it was very simple. That is an expression of my passion. That was the instrument after trying to make music on three or four other things, violin, flute, clarinet, saxophone, whatever. Guitar was the thing that spoke to me. Guitar was the thing that took me in at my least competent. And guitar is the thing that rewards incompetence in a lot of ways. Electric guitar rewards people who have no idea what they're doing, more so than any other instrument. So I thought, hey, maybe I don't have to be hemophilia all the time. I can be like 50% guitar, 50% hemophilia. That seems like a way healthier outlook on life. So I decided, you know, I based my personality on all of this, and I loved it. And I loved what it was, you know, it was, I felt myself in rock and roll. And so if I was going to give that up, there'd have to be a good reason for it. And so there wasn't. Like they said that it would be activities that might provoke more bleeding. And I said, what isn't? Brushing my hair is an issue. I'm right-handed. This is my right elbow. That, you know, that requires lots of modification, and you're still in pain. And so I think I on my terms, I decided that if I'm going to be in pain, and I'm in a lot of pain, I manage it better now, and I'm nowhere in as much pain as I was when I was having these thoughts. I was terrified. I was paranoid. I was delirious with pain, because if you've never been in constant pain, it's the equivalent and sometimes directly linked to staying up for prolonged periods of time. Like, you know, sometimes the pain will literally make you stay up and lose sleep, but to be in this place of constant stimulus and agitation, it does things to your mind. That's literally something that we do as a torture method. And so when you're not managing that well, it's like, well, if I'm going to feel like this anyway, why do I care what other people are telling me to do? I'm my own person. And rock and roll is a middle finger that's in your heart. And so I kept going. And what I did by doing that was I went from bone on bone to bone on less bone. I created joint space in my elbow by wearing away at a bone. The way that wind and water wore away at the plains and made the Grand Canyon. So through sheer force of will, I got better by getting worse in a way, which is a fun thing to say, but also, dear God, dear God, dear God, the horror that is my x-rays. And on that, I would really like to make a broader point that this isn't just about hemophilia. This is something that applies to everybody in their life, because my story isn't unique, even though it is about a rare disease. I'm hitting all of the same plot points and drinking from the same emotional wells that other people journey to find and journey through. I just have my own course through them. This is pain that's universal. You know, pain is universal. Sadness is universal. Anger is universal. And we forget that, unfortunately. And what I want to say as sort of my closing sentiment to take away on this is, we're all going to be sacrificing. Life is sacrifice. We choose to do things with our time. We sacrifice our time for the sake of things, or we sacrifice our energy for the sake of things, or we sacrifice our health for the sake of things. And I know it's not wise to sacrifice your health, but sometimes we are in positions where there is no other option in order to do what needs to be done. And what needs to be done is an abstract thing that only we can decide for ourselves. So to make those judgment calls for yourself is paramount. And I say all of this to implore people, if you can do things that you love, do them. Sacrifice for those. Don't let somebody or something arbitrarily take away from you what gives you joy, even if it means you're sacrificing. Because sacrifice is worth it, you know?
That's really powerful. Thank you, Max. And thank you for joining me today. Where can people experience your music, find out more about you, all that kind of stuff?
You can find me on Instagram and Threads at Blood and Sound. My music is available through the links on those profiles, and you can find it on any streaming platform you like.
Visit phantomastronaut.com for all of the different ways that you can help us to continue to create. And I will see you out there.